Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network, a podcast dedicated to speaking with authors on their most recently published work. My name is Matthew Long. I will be your host for this Islamic Studies section interview with Professor Asma Saeed. Studies on the subject of women's participation in religious and intellectual life in Islam have been few. Women and the Transmission of Religious Knowledge in Islam by Professor Asma Saeed of UCLA is a much-needed addition to the fields of history, the study of Islam, and women's studies. Professor Saeed leads readers through 9 centuries of religious, social, and intellectual history of women's participation as transmitters of Hadith, the words and actions of Muhammad. Women's participation within this area was not static, but ebbed and flowed throughout history as demonstrated in this book's 4 chapters. Women were critical in the dissemination of Hadith in the first century of Islam. However, as the study of Hadith became more specialized from the 4th to 10th century, women were marginalized as transmitters, which Saeed validates with quantitative data from chains of transmissions, or isnads, from numerous Hadith collections. By the 10th century, however, the canonization of Hadith was by and large complete, which ushered in a new phase in which women again became important actors in the reception and propagation of Hadith. This period would last until the end of the Mamluk period and the rise of the Ottomans in the 16th century. However, this second decline in women's participation would be for different reasons. Throughout each phase of this history, Professor Saeed provides case studies on different women to further her argument of the participation of women, even at the least active moments, as propagators of Hadith. Professor Saeed has brought new understanding of women's intellectual lives in the history of Islam and has opened the door for further inquiry into this often understudied subject.
Hello, and welcome to the Islamic Studies section of the New Books Network. Today we're speaking with Professor Asma Saeed about her book, Women and the Transmission of Religious Knowledge in Islam. Hello, Professor.
Hi, how are you, Matthew?
I'm doing well, and you?
Good, thank you.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for joining us today to talk about your book. And I really want to say that this was a great read and probably something, there have been a lot of contributions to the field of Islam related to women, but I think this one was also probably long overdue. And it's an excellent study on a specific genre, and that's Hadith. But I will get to that in 1 second. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, you know, biography, a little bit about your studies as well?
Sure, absolutely. I am currently Associate Professor of Islamic Studies in the Department of Near Eastern Languages and Cultures at UCLA. My specialties really, my research specialties, I like to think of them as within early and classical Islamic history, focusing on social history, the intersections of social history and law, and women's studies as well. And I am particularly now interested in the history of Islamic education. I teach undergraduate courses on Intro to Islam, Islam in the West, which takes me a bit out of my range of specialty, and the Quran, and then graduate seminars on various topics of interest to me. I also teach one on research methodology.
Wonderful. So can you tell us a little bit about how you came to write this work?
Sure. I have to say, I mean, there are different trajectories that brought me here. My journey to Islamic studies, if you want to call it that, it actually started at Princeton when I was an undergraduate student. And I was exposed to the thought and work of 2 people who eventually became my mentors, Hussein Madarisi, who teaches Islamic law and Shiism, among other subjects at Princeton, and Michael Cook, who is a very well-known historian, of course. And they had a profound influence on me with respect to my approaches to the sources, my understanding of what constitutes good history in Islamic studies. And, I transitioned from, of course, undergraduate to graduate work at Princeton. And I had, around the time I became a graduate student, I was becoming increasingly interested in understanding women's roles in contemporary Muslim societies and in making sense of sort of what I think are very conflicting views about women's status in Islamic doctrine and thought. And around this time, I also had the good fortune to meet Khalid Abul Fadl, who's a leading Muslim public intellectual who joined the Near Eastern Studies Department at Princeton as a graduate student at the time. And T2 was very much concerned with the history of Muslim women and their roles in contemporary Muslim societies. And at one point, we had a conversation about the very rich history of women as jurists, that is, as legal scholars in the Muslim tradition. And I thought to myself, yeah, that's really interesting. I haven't heard about Muslim jurists. I'd love to know about them. And I began to look for them in the historical sources. And instead of coming across lots and lots of jurists, I came across basically hundreds of female hadith transmitters in the historical records, and they just hadn't been studied. And this was also around the time in the late 1990s, I believe, when we started seeing reports of the Taliban's very harsh policies towards women's education in Afghanistan. And all of these, you know, what I was seeing in the contemporary world was very much contradicting what I was reading about in history. And I started to try to make sense of this history and the ways in which Muslims understood women's religious education and participation. And this basically, I mean, guided by, I think my mentors were sort of very, very much invested in understanding the sources for what they meant at the time. This became the project that I decided to devote my career to, unraveling this history.
And that's exactly what you do in your introduction to the work. You talk about a broad time period, starting all the way from the first century in the Islamic calendar, all the way till pretty far. Well, it's at least until the 16th century, 17th right. century modern. So, and you develop a very clear thesis of specific time periods and how, you know, things change over those time periods for women as transmitters.
Right.
Could you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're talking specifically about the chronology, right?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I just want to step back a little bit before I talk okay. about the chronology and talk about how I got there as well, because I think, or I got to understanding the chronology, because I think that is important and interesting. When I first surveyed the sources, I saw that there was a real concentration of material in the Mamluk period, particularly around the 13th and the 14th centuries of the Christian era. And that's where the source material is very rich. And we have, you know, a lot of primary sources that are detailed from there. And I knew, you know, I thought, okay, I'm just going to work on Mamluk woman and get this dissertation done, written. But I knew that I first needed to understand sort of the broad outlines of women's participation in this domain. I expected no surprises. I mean, I just started kind of reading from, you know, the sources that we have at the beginnings of Islamic history up to the Mamluk period, just taking very detailed notes. And as my research progressed and I was organizing my notes, I discovered that there is a really unexpected chronology. It's the chronology of the establishment of a tradition in the era of the companions, that is, those who actually saw Muhammad and were reporting on his actions and deeds after his death. And then there's this incredible disappearance of women from the records altogether. And sort of around the fourth, let's say the end of the ninth, beginning of the 10th century of the Common Era, there's a slow revival of women's participation. That really becomes a flourishing, a peaking in the Mamluk period, and then it wanes again in the early Ottoman period around the beginning of the 16th century. So, you know, this is a really unexpected chronology. I could not understand what it was that would lead to women completely disappearing from the historical record for about a period of a century and a half to two centuries. Why? Prior to the rise of feminism, right, which we credit with all things positive related to women, there would be this incredible revival of women in the domain. So, you know, each chapter is kind of devoted to examining what's going on in distinct periods of Islamic history within a broader historical context. And of course, with respect to women's hadith participation.
Mm-hmm. Well, then, shall we just go ahead and jump right into it?
Absolutely.
Okay. So then the introductory, the first chapter, you are looking at that section of the companions.
Right.
And you, you talk about a number of different sort of categories. There are certain categories that form the bulk, and then other categories that play a significant role, but they're not quite as strong in terms of just the sheer number quantitatively in terms of how hadith were transmitted from Muhammad.
Mm-hmm. I'm happy to elaborate on that more. In the era of companions, I mean, we have something like, let's say, 10 to 12% of women who are the narrators or are credited with being the narrators of tradition amongst all companion narrators. And of course, there are two figures that are very important as far as women go in this period. And I should say, of course, here it's Aisha, who is known as being one of the favored wives of the Prophet Muhammad, according to some, the favorite wife of the Prophet Muhammad, who's credited with something like 1,200 traditions. Or hadith reports. And then there's Salama, who is also another leading, very prominent wife of the Prophet Muhammad, who's credited with far less, but something like 370 traditions, if I remember correctly. And then after that, you have, the woman I studied, the numbers are, I think, like 110 women left who come from all different walks of life, let's say. Some of them are the kin of Muhammad, his aunts, in different ways, just related to him. There are those who were interestingly prominent as contributors to the battle effort. There were women who sought his fatwas or legal edicts on different matters. And so their words or their experiences with Prophet Muhammad are recorded in the hadith, but they really run the whole range of different types of actors, let's say actresses in early Islamic society.
And you also talk about some of the circumstances that in which some of these traditions were related as well.
Right. Take, for example, and there's a very interesting case that crops up in a number of other studies that predated mine, but there's a very well-known woman named Fatima bint Qais, who had been divorced or had been issued a proclamation of divorce from her husband while he was away at battle. And the whole case revolves around whether this woman, Fatima, is owed any kind of allowance, to help her get through in Islamic law is called the waiting period, right after her divorce, before she can remarry. And interestingly, in the records that we have, Fatima reports what the Prophet told her, which is that she's not owed any such allowance by her ex-husband. And the reasons for that are complex. I don't want to get into them. But beyond that, I mean, it's intriguing because she sort of argues with the governor of Medina, Marwan, at the time, as well as with other very prominent companions about the ways in which her report should be interpreted and how Islamic law should be derived from it. A very different example is of a woman named Asma bint Abi Bakr, who is actually Aisha's sister. And she has a number of very interesting traditions. Some of them relate to the ways in which, what the Prophet advised when they were praying at the time of the solar eclipse. I mean, it seems to be a very sort of random set of traditions, but it actually has implications for ritual practice, implications for understanding how Muslims absorbed sort of the understanding of what a solar eclipse meant in their religious tradition. Then we have reports of women talking about their participation in the battle, seeing Muhammad leading prayers, seeing Muhammad sort of being the recipient of revelations, all different settings, basically, for their reports.
Okay. And what did you find most intriguing during this aspect of your study?
I think just the range, the incredible range of women's reports that they're credited with. I mean, I think that, you know, when we think about what kinds of areas women may be authoritative for, right, when transmitting religious knowledge. I mean, certainly my gut instinct when I started this research was to expect that women would be transmitting information about stuff related to women. So in Islamic law, for example, there's a whole area of law called ritual purity, dealing with different aspects of purity, ritual purity for the purposes of performing prayers and other ritual actions. And I thought, okay, women are going to be talking a lot about that. Women are going to be talking about domestic matters, right? How relationships with husbands, divorce, et cetera. But I mean, really, I found that women reported on all sorts of topics. I mean, there is a bit of a concentration for Aisha and Salama and some of the other wives on issues that we might call woman-specific issues, but there really is a range. And, you know, related to that, it's I think that range reflects a communal memory of women being active in all different arenas, public arenas as well as private ones. Yeah, that's what was intriguing for me.
And what I definitely, one part that I remember was that something that you had said about Aisha specifically about her range of distribution, that she sort of, I don't know if you would say, kind of absconded what we might think of as traditional passing from one person to another, that she actually transmitted to a number of different people.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, yeah. She's and that's true of a number of these women. I mean, they're I think it may be anachronistic to call them learning networks for this very early period. We don't really have formalized learning networks. The extent to which men and women from all different walks of life saw these women as authoritative, and ultimately when we look back, we call them learning networks, but, they were clearly authoritative for a range of people, male and female.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. And, then after this kind of initial period, we kind of then move forward to the next section of your work where we talk about the successors.
Right.
And you lay out some case studies, but in that chapter, you really develop sort of a different phase of what's occurring.
Yes, absolutely. For the listeners, successors here is a technical term referring to the generation immediately after the companions. Late first century of the Islamic calendar, around the 8th and 9th centuries is what I'm talking about for the Common Era calendar. And I use successors in that technical sense, but also a broader category of sort of the two or three generations immediately after the companions. And, being people who expect historical continuities, I guess, I'm certainly one of them. I fully expected that we would continue to see this tradition of women's participation in hadith, or just a woman being involved in transmitting reports about the Prophet in generations after the companions. And not only do I expect to see a continuity, but I expected that women would do more with the tradition. That is, that they would develop their legal learning, be involved in sort of communication of knowledge that showed a sense of legal discernment. How can we apply this in terms of Islamic law? What principles can be derived from it, et cetera? And I didn't see that. In fact, as I discuss in my book, I mean, there really only are a handful of women in the successor generation. Amra bint Abdurrahman is one. Hafsa bint Sirin is another. Umar Darda as a third. And I think there I've covered the three main prominent women of that generation. But they're really, and even their activity is fairly constrained. So there's this, initially there's a very sharp decline. And then there's this complete disappearance of women from the historical records and with respect to their hadith transmission. And it really is striking because in the generation before, I mean, women really are, they're not everywhere, but there are substantial amounts of them and they're active. And, you know, I think that what was interesting to me here is that across religious traditions, I mean, whether we're talking about Buddhism, Christianity, Judaism, there is this idea that what we might call the institutionalization of religious tradition. Soon after the death of the founder, once we begin to see articulation of religious institutions, theologies, doctrine, you do see a decline in women's participation. And we see something very similar with respect to women here. I think it's the professionalization of hadith, that is the creation of, if not institutions, then more formalized networks for transmitting hadith that's responsible for women falling out of the picture, as it were. There are several criteria that are really important or become important for people to continue to engage in this arena, which is formalized as the arena of hadith transmission. And, you know, one of them is that you need to be able to go meet with your teacher face to face. I mean, the idea that you sat with the teacher, spent a long time learning from him what his traditions were and getting an explanation for you know, sort of their legal implications, that was very important. Another thing that was important was being able to display a sense of legal acumen, legal discernment, which also requires a particular type of training. And finally, around this time, that is the around the 8th, 9th centuries, you begin to see a movement, which we call the Rihla movement, right? But these are journeys that often solitary journeys that scholars undertook in order to collect reports or traditions directly from the source. So say you were sitting in Mecca, you heard that somebody in Basra or Baghdad had, was a good transmitter of one particular hadith report. He would just pack up and go across the desert and go get that hadith directly from the source. And of course, I mean, you're talking about an era in which women didn't just pack up. They often had families. The journeys were long and dangerous. And so it was unusual. The bars were very high, basically, for women to be able to participate, to continue to participate in this domain. And so I think that's why you see this really precipitous decline and then just a disappearance of them from the record.
And it's, I should say, the statistics that you provide, the analysis is very telling. You provide some very accurate, I mean, at one point you quote 88% for women who are in the chains of transmission or isnad as the first link, and then it drops to 38% for women who are in the third link. So there's definitely this proof is right there when you look at the chains of transmission.
That's really very striking.
Yeah. One thing that I did want to ask, because of this idea of the network for individuals who aren't as familiar, that some of these networks were very much shared, but those who were not in the same networks, the same learning networks, were there any sort of discrepancies in the amount of hadith transmitted by women in different collections?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, and again, we're talking about the earlier period. I mean, the ways in which these learning networks functioned, let's say, across Islamic history really differs, from one period to the next. But in the earlier period, let's say the generation of the companions and these successors, I mean, learning was So for example, Aisha, right? Let's say Aisha bint Abi Bakr, the wife of the Prophet, is the best example. A lot of men and women would go to her, would try to find her to learn a number of different traditions from her, right? And people in subsequent generations knew who her students were. One of them was her nephew, Urwa. Another was this woman, Amra bint Abdurrahman, right, who's her niece. And so the networks of these women in the successor generation, somebody like Amra, they actually were more extensive because people knew that Amra had the hadith, or she was teaching the hadith of Aisha, who herself was known to be a prolific transmitter of traditions. So a lot of people sought her out for that. I hope that answers your question.
No, it does. Okay. Yes. Thank you very much. No, but like I said before, though, the information and the sort of the quantitative analysis is very striking in this chapter in terms of the decline.
I have to say, on that note, Matthew, I still remember that feeling of, okay, I'm doing something wrong. There's something I'm not checking. And so, I spent an incredible amount of time checking across a range of sources, thinking, there's something missing here. I haven't found the right book. I found the right book that tells me what women are doing in this period. And it really, that feeling of sort of something is amiss, I still remember it very clearly.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you. And so then this is kind of what, I guess, for the entirety of the book, what we would kind of say is the sort of the nadir, the kind of the lower end.
Yes.
And then as we start to transition out of this period, we kind of then see a revival. And the revival is not a short-lived, it's a very long, long-lived revival, beginning around the 4th century in Islam, the 10th century CE. And can you kind of start leading us through that portion of your work?
Absolutely. When you see the, what I call the revival in the classical sources, it's not an overwhelming one initially. I mean, it begins very slowly. I mean, you have a handful of entries in the biographical dictionaries of farther east, let's say in Nishapur. You have women showing up in the biographical dictionaries there as being trustworthy sheikhas, right, who were transmitting reports. So around the 4th century of the Hijri calendar. They're mentioned as trustworthy sheikhas, and they're also sometimes mentioned as transmitting whole collections of hadith. So in the early period, right, around the companions and successors, you have women transmitting individual reports. But here in this revival period, women are transmitting collections of reports. So that's your first indication that something different is going on, right? And indeed, I mean, this ties into a point I want to make about the reasons for this revival. What I discovered in my research, as I tried to correlate trends in the participation of women across time and place with these chronological, I mean, with what was going on, sort of broadly speaking, in terms of hadith transmission and just sort of political and social history in this period in Islam, is that there are a number of noteworthy trends going on at the same time. One very important one for my work is what we call the canonization of hadith. Whereas in the earliest decades, and say up to the first century and a half of Islamic history, you just had a lot of reports that were floating around, some of them fabricated, some of them not. By the 4th century, the Sunnis at least have authoritative collections of hadith, which scholars have sifted through tens of thousands of reports, and they said, okay, these are the ones that we're going to count on for deriving Islamic law. These are the most trustworthy ones. So those are, other scholars start to accept these as authoritative, and there's this growing movement, let's say, to canonize these authoritative collections. That becomes very important for women, because what you can do, starting in the late 4th, early 5th centuries, you can transmit a collection of hadith and know that what you're transmitting is everybody accepts as accurate. You don't need to really sort of be well-versed in Arabic grammar or the accurate transmission of traditions. You just need to memorize that book, basically. And that was important for women. I mean, they started to transmit collections, but they didn't need legal discernment or legal knowledge to be able to sift through these traditions. Also, at this time, sort of hadith transmission is becoming more of a distinct arena from law and legal learning. And so women are able to flourish in the arena of hadith transmission. We don't see them as much in the arena of law. There's also the growing acceptance of written transmission, which, I mean, you may not expect this, but it enables women to participate in this field again, because, what they can do is they can count on written books instead of having to go directly to a teacher, many of them male, and having to study one-on-one with them. They can just study the books at home, essentially, and transmit them later. And accuracy is very important. I don't mean to sort of diminish what women are doing here, but, you know, they are freed from basically from the demands of direct oral transmission. And lastly, this becomes more of an issue, but later, let's say, around the 5th or 6th century, and it's a complex social phenomenon, but we begin to see the scholarly classes or the scholars sort of identifying themselves more and more in terms of kinship-based groupings. They're families of ulama, and one of the hallmarks of a good ulama family is that the men and the women both imbibed religious learning. And in this context, there was a greater incentive for men to train their daughters and the woman of their family group. And women also then had family networks within which they could circulate to engage in religious learning. So these are the three primary reasons why I think over time you see this revival of women in this domain.
And regarding that last example, you actually provide case studies to support that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, the case study that I think is an early case study that's very interesting is that of Fatima bint al-Hassan, who is actually the wife of a very well-known classical scholar, al-Qushayri. And, you know, she is the daughter of the teacher, the Sheikh of al-Qushayri. And it's clear that, you know, her learning, as well as the learning of her daughters and other women in the family, was very much a part of pedigree, you know, pedigree of establishing an ulama family that was known for their trade, essentially trade in law and in learning traditions.
And one thing that you mentioned, that to not digress too much, but you're talking really throughout this work about the Sunni.
Yes.
And not so much of the development and transmission within Shia circles.
Absolutely.
But you do actually, you have produced work on that as well.
Yes, I have. And, you know, I think that, again, I have to thank my mentors for this, especially Hussein Mudarrisi. And I think this, you know, it's very important, especially when it comes to women's history, to not paint all of women's history with these broad brushstrokes. I have to confess that I expected similar patterns in the Shi'i sphere. In the course of the research for the book, I didn't really have time to look at the Shi'i sources that closely. I looked at some of them, and I saw, and I didn't see. You know, it seemed to me to be similar. But after I completed the book, I went back and looked at the sources, and it's actually quite different. I mean, the tradition of woman's hadith transmission doesn't really take hold in Shi'ism, and here I'm talking about Imami Shi'ism, in the same way that it does in Sunni Islam. And there are a number of reasons for this, historical reasons for this, but in general, in Imami Shi'ism, hadith learning doesn't occupy the same space that it does in Sunni culture. And so we see some very different patterns in the Shi'i sphere.
Absolutely. So we shouldn't expect the same trajectory, that Shia trajectory would be quite different.
There's just less of this type of activity going on overall in Shi'ism, or fewer records of it, let's say.
Okay. And then also one other thing is that, in addition, I know that really one of the most important thing was this canonization, but I also believe that you talk about, and I might be jumping ahead a little bit, about kind of basically the role that Hadith had played earlier versus this time period as well.
I didn't fully understand the
I guess in terms of its role within the study of Islam itself, of religion, because there was at least in the initial periods, I know that you spoke about the Ahl al-Hadith, and that development, and then that, I don't know if I'm a little ahead of myself, but that's become more, that Hadith are now part of, you know, what needs to be examined for legal rulings and things like that, whereas that role, like Mu'tazilites, for instance, relied heavily on Quran and reason, and Hadith was not part of their, you know what they relied upon.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's a great question. I mean, it goes to a point that I make early on in the book, that I think that one of the things that we need to be attuned to, in understanding this history, is what we might call the social uses of knowledge. Right. You're absolutely right that in the early period, that is the period of the companions and the successors, there's a lot more scrutiny as to actually just the value of Hadith itself. I mean, Western scholarly tradition has called our attention to the fact that, you know, Hadith are susceptible to forgeries. Right. But Muslims were aware of this from the beginnings of their history onwards. And so there was a real debate within Muslim intellectual circles about, you know, what's the use of these hadith? People could make it up very easily. How are we going to use them as a bedrock of for deriving Islamic law? And I think that, you know, women's participation sort of fell victim to those, let's say, one of the reasons you see a decline is that the role of Hadith really was not settled in that early period. But once it became settled, and this is where I talk about, in my work, I talk about the importance of Sunni traditionalism and the ways in which it promoted the study of Hadith. Once it became settled that Hadith are indeed important sources for Sunnis of law, I mean, the second most important source, it became a marker of piety and one's sort of station in terms of one's standing in the scholarly circles to memorize Hadith, to transmit it accurately. You know, again, getting back to the idea of social uses of knowledge, I mean, because of other changes as well, that I talked about, such as written transmission, et cetera, women could easily tap into this social use to acquire a type of cultural capital for themselves. I mean, they were accepted as hadith transmitters because it was a good thing to do in that society. I mean, it was meritorious in a variety of ways.
Thank you. And then transitioning into the fourth and final chapter of the four main chapters of your work, it's the continuation of this. Well, at this point, it's not really a revival, but the continuation of
We call it the culmination, I think.
The culmination that lasts from about the 12th to the 15th century, and then there's kind of then you talk about another decline, but that decline happens for different reasons right. than the decline that happened after the first century.
Yes.
So would you go ahead and lead us through that as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so here too, I mean, in the last chapter, I mean, I kind of center my chapter on case studies, and the two case studies I have here are of fairly prolific Mamluk hadith transmitters, Zainab bint al-Kamal and Aisha bint Muhammad ibn Abd al-Hadi. And I mean, it's the continuation of some of the same trends, right? The importance of hadith learning for ulama families, the importance of written transmission, or the acceptability of written transmission. But in this classical period, I mean, one new thing that we see here is the importance of what are called isnad ali, that is, short chains of transmission. And the idea here is that Muslims are getting farther and farther. I mean, by the Mamluk period, 13th, 14th century, Muslims are very conscious of being farther and farther away from the authority of the Prophet, farther removed from the Golden Age. And in an attempt to sort of, be closer to that period, it was thought that if you acquired the shortest possible chains of transmission, then that would, sort of be a marker of piety. It was considered something valuable in this society. And in this context, hadith transmitters who lived long lives and who could learn hadith when they were very, very young, right, and then transmit them when they were very, very old, were valuable, because using them meant that you could shorten the trains of transmission. And, intriguingly, there's this, women are known for their longevity. And in this period as well, many of the well-known hadith transmitters that we have are very long-lived women. So Zainab bint al-Kamal, for example, I mean, it recurs in her biographies that she transmitted with short chains of transmission. She lived to be nearly 100 years old. Aisha, I think, died in her 80s or 90s. But they, again, there's a cultural value to being associated with these women who had learned the material very, very well, and who also lived long enough to transmit it with short chains. So that's something new that's going on in this period that helps to account for women being continuing to be coveted sources of hadith.
And then as you talk about with the rise of the end of the I guess it would be the end of the Mamluk period, or the rise of the Ottomans.
The rise of the Ottomans,
Yes, it's the sort of a new period of decline.
Yeah, and, to be honest, I mean, this is something that I, there are two trends that I saw in this period, and I did not have a chance to explore them as fully as I'd wanted to, but my sense is that hadith learning overall is not as important, or hadith learning for the sake of hadith learning, right? Not as a tool or an avenue to becoming a jurist, for example. It doesn't have the same cachet that it in the Ottoman period, early Ottoman period, that it did in the Mamluk period. So I think women fall out of the picture partly for that reason. And another reason is, let's say they're diverted. I started to see in the historical records increasing references to women who were accomplished as Sufis who had joined tariqas, right, and were known for their Sufi practices or Sufi learnings. There are also increasing mentions of women who are known for their poetry, but less and less for hadith transmission. And I think this is true of men as well. But again, I didn't have a chance to do sort of a thorough study. So I don't feel as comfortable making these assertions with respect to the early Ottoman period.
Mm-hmm. And then we move on to the conclusion, and you actually made reference to some of the conclusions that you found throughout this book. Specifically, one thing that stuck out to me was parallels to, in terms of comparative religious studies,
right.
How these trends have kind of how they're mirrored in other traditions.
Right. It's what I've mentioned before, that I think that institutionalization across religious traditions has the bad reputation of not being friendly to women. That in different ways, institutionalizations of let's say church structures or religious hierarchies means that women, for one reason or the other, are excluded from these structures, or that it's hard for them to gain authority because of whatever bars are in place. I don't know that it's, I think that what I'm arguing in the Muslim case is not explicit. This is not explicit discrimination against women, per se. It's happenstance. And it's because of this happenstance that women are, their roles are refashioned later on in the classical period. I think that's a very strong case right there for saying that this is not because of explicit gender discrimination in the Muslim case. And I think that, there are others who've done studies in Hinduism, Buddhism, Christianity, and Judaism, looking at the ways in which women reemerge as religious authority figures in less formal spheres or outside institutional structures. And I think these kinds of parallels really need to be teased out in work that's more rigorously comparative than mine was. But it's fascinating to me to see how, there are these similarities.
The overlap, yes.
Yeah.
Are there any other concluding notes that our listeners should know about?
I think that, one of the, I guess, I don't know that I would call it a regret, but I guess I would say a footnote here is that given the current interest in, women and their religious participation, particularly women as figures of authority in the contemporary world, thanks to, fairly conservative, I would say radical groups in Afghanistan, Iraq, et cetera. There is this question about whether women can serve as authoritative figures and, whether they're entitled to religious education. I think works such as mine sort of put that notion to rest. It's a well-established tradition in Islam. But I think what I also intend to say in this book is that the tradition of the female hadith transmitter is not really one that we should expect to see now. Because historical circumstances don't call for it, right? We have very different contexts, or actually our contemporary contexts don't call for it. We have very different contexts right now. But what we do see, and very interestingly, when we think about women in religious education in Islam, is that increasingly women are gaining familiarity, or not familiarity, I'm sorry, are being acknowledged as jurists and as exegetes, that is, Quran interpreters of the Quran. And that's fascinating to me, right? What is it about contemporary circumstances that allows women to emerge as authority figures in different contexts? And how are they calling upon tradition to legitimize what they do and to give themselves more authority? So I think that there is the part two will not be written by me, certainly, but there is a part two to be written here that I think could be potentially be very interesting because of contemporary contexts.
Great. Well, thank you very much for all the time that you've taken to speak with us. Before we let you go, are there any upcoming projects that you'd like to tell our listeners about?
Sure. I have actually made my way a little bit more to the modern period recently. My interest in education continues, this is education more broadly speaking. My next project actually has to do with what I call the texts and textual practices of contemporary Muslim education in different centers across the world. So right now I'm focusing on Morocco. Muslim education is another one of these hot topics right now, but we know very little actually about what people are reading, how they're reading it when they say when somebody goes to study Islamic law in centers for learning today. So I'm trying to document actually what texts are being used and the ways in which people are engaging with those texts. I mean, how are they memorizing them? Are they analyzing them? And I'm trying to focus on educational centers that welcome or have male and female enrollments, so that women and men are acquiring higher Islamic education in those centers.
Permit you some field study.
Something. I mean, I'm a textualist, and I think I always will be one. But it requires that I travel a bit more than this project did. Yeah, so I'll be headed off to Morocco this summer.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. This was great.
Okay. Thanks for speaking with us.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us as we spoke with Professor Asma Saeed about her book, Women and the Transmission of Religious Knowledge in Islam. Be sure to stay tuned in the upcoming weeks for another posting on the Islamic Studies section, or be sure to check out one of our other channels here on the New Books Network. Thank you very much for joining us.